Hi, I'm Raven. So I'm not sure you really want to get inside my mind because it's kind of a dangerous place and you may not get out. But be that as it may, we'll continue and try anyway.
Sometimes a choice is made for us, and sometimes there is no choice. Call the Raven.
Hello everyone, and welcome to a very special shoot interview series with one of the biggest names in wrestling today. His work for every promotion has meant something in the last 10 years. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Raven.
Thank you.
How you doing, man?
We need some applause here. There's some people in the background here to applaud.
Okay, basically what we're going to be doing today is a very special shoot interview. We're basically going to be, instead of asking...
I think you should have brought more people first of all, because I get some applause. I like applause. I think that'd have been nice if there'd have been some applause, and so the next time I do one, I want applause.
Okay.
I want you to bring like at least 8 people, you know, to simulate that there's a huge crowd, like that I'm over or something.
We'll make sure that gets done.
Outstanding.
Okay. So basically, what we're going to be asking you today, instead of about your career, because that's been done before, we're going to be asking you basically, we want to get inside your mind, and basically an insight on the business.
First of all, I'm not sure you really want to get inside my mind because it's kind of a dangerous place, and you may not get out. But be that as it may, we'll continue and try anyway.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Should I look at this camera or that camera?
You can look whatever you want.
I'll look at this camera, and then you can kind of track that on the side. Since the battery's kind of dead on that one anyway, right?
Yeah.
All right, so I'll look mainly at this one.
Very considerate of you. Thank you. Okay, so first, before we decide to like find out your insights into business, we need to know how you started in the business. And my first question to you is, when did you decide that you wanted to get into pro wrestling? You know, did you have an epiphany? As, you know, people watch as a child, and basically.
Yeah, absolutely. When I was a kid, I wanted to be a pro wrestler, and I remember I used to wrestle my buddies, and one time I put this kid, Chris Drugan, in a hammerlock, and I didn't realize I was really hurting him, and he started crying. He was 8 years old, you know, we were like 8 years old, I got him in a hammerlock, and I was cranking on it, you know, and like he was all, and I was like, I didn't even know I was hurting him, you know what I mean? Anyway, so I always wanted to do it as a kid, and but, you know, I never really thought that I'd actually do it. It's like people want to be actors, but they don't actually, you know, very few people actually decide to go into it. You know, you want to do it, but not a lot of people actually do it. And so then, you know, childhood dreams fade away, and it's kind of funny. Like I knew I was going to be a pro athlete. I was a very good. I mean, I was a pretty good athlete as a kid, but I wasn't a great athlete in high school. I was like a mid-carder at best, and so I never really thought much about being an athlete again. You know, after my childhood dreams had disappeared, and then at some point I was in college. And I decided I needed to be famous. Like, I needed to be in an occupational field where I would be famous, rich and famous. And probably having to do with some, you know, self-worth issues and some insecurity. So, you know, I figured if the entire world loves me, you know, then I couldn't be a bad person. Which is why a lot of people, you know, want to become famous. And then I started thinking about wrestling again. And you know, I still went, you know, to the matches all the time. And I was watching TV one time. And, I mean, as I'm wont to do, I used to watch wrestling every week, and Ricky Santana, who you may or may not have heard of, who's, I think he's the booker for Carlos Colon in Puerto Rico right now. I was watching a show, and he was on, and he was on every week, and I think they were, I thought they were the tag team champions, but I'm not so sure they were now. And, Ricky actually became a good friend of mine later on, but, so me and, him and David Sierra, who's been a longtime journeyman, they were like, they had like a pretty good push as these Puerto Ricans, bad attitudes, you know, heels. And watching the show, and Ricky's playing his pretty boy heel character. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm better looking than he is. I was like, I'm better built than he is. And I'm like, well, look, if he can do it, I can do it. And that was my decision. I decided ultimately to do it. And, you know, Ricky doesn't like that story too much. But that's why ultimately I decided to do it. And I finished up, got my degree in college, and then went to the Monster Factory, and then that's where it started.
Okay. So we just established now, you went to the Monster Factory, you were trained by Larry Shaw, I believe.
I wasn't actually trained by Larry, because Larry was in Japan with Bam Bam Bigelow. So Charlie Fulton, who was a longtime WWE jobber, trained me, who was a very good hand. And my training took all of 1 month. One of the few things in my life I've ever been a complete natural at. And literally I trained for a month, and Larry was like, look, there's nothing else I can teach you. He goes, you can keep coming to the school, but, you know, I picked up headlocks, arm drags, hip toss. I mean, you know, obviously it was a lot of psychology. There was a lot to learn because you never stop learning. But, I mean, there wasn't anything else I was going to learn at a school. You know, I needed to go in front of people and wrestle, you know, nightly. And so I started trying to book myself out, and I sent tapes out. I ended up having about 7 matches in this 9-month period. I 1 month of school, and then for the next 8 months, I basically sent out my tape, and every 2 or 3 weeks I would call Dono and some Portland, and I'd call Florida, I'd call Continental, I'd call Puerto Rico, and called, you know, every promotion there was, because there was still a lot of promotions left. You know, they all hadn't gone the way of the dinosaur yet. And eventually Lawler decided to bring me in. And so I went down there, and so I got down to Memphis after having about 7-8 matches.
Okay. So before you started your training at the Monster Factory, obviously, you know, wrestling's very tough, it's very physical. Were you aware of that, you know, did someone tell you beforehand, you know, what sort of shape you had to? Obviously, you were an athlete, but, you know, what sort of shape?
I wasn't a very good athlete. You know, I wasn't a bad athlete, but I wasn't a good one. But I was always into weightlifting, you know, and lifting weights and, you know, looking good, you know. And honestly, I knew it was a work. You know, I mean, you know, obviously it has to be a work, you know, because nobody could withstand that. And so it never dawned on me how tough it was going to be, you know. I am an ex-Marine, you know, United States Marine. When I was in college, I took a semester off and went to Marine Corps boot camp, which is the toughest thing you can do other than going to, like, you know, Ranger school or SEAL training. And I was the leader of my platoon. I graduated maybe one of the first and only people to ever go from forming day 2 through final graduation and winning final drill as the guide, which is the leader of the platoon and the guy that holds the stick with the flag on it. And so I knew physically I was a tough person, but if I'd have known how tough wrestling was, I don't know. I mean, it just never dawned on me that it was going to be that physically hard, you know? And the first day of training, I was in so much agony. Like, I moved from, I lived in Florida, and I moved up to New Jersey to go to school, which right over the bridge from Philadelphia. And I moved up there, and I must have banged my head, like, every time I took a bump. And it was so ungodly. Like, looking back now, I probably had a minor concussion, you know what I mean? I mean, that's how ill I was. But, I mean, what was I going to do, go home with my tail between my legs and tell my buddies I couldn't cut it? So I was like, well, I got to gut this out. And then eventually it just became second nature, and the pain went away and, you know, what have you.
Okay. So,
you have that thing aimed at me correctly?
Yes.
I got a feeling that you're going to be shooting, like, this is going to be a shot of my neck and my nipple.
No, it's definitely your head.
All right.
Okay.
What happens when the battery runs out on that?
I'll panic.
Okay.
Okay.
Typically British attitude. Aren't you people repressed? It'll be like a repressed panic. You'll be like, ooh, it's out. That'd be like a repressed panic.
So, you just mentioned now that your training routine was pretty tough. What was the typical?
But it really wasn't, though. I mean, that's the thing is, I'm just saying that wrestling is tough. People don't realize, like, a lot of it's our fault. Like, you know, people, we have matches where guys go through leg tables, ladders, and chairs, and then because they don't sell very well, which is the heart of this business, that the match is over, they're like, hey, I'm fine, and the next week they show up and they're not taped up or bandaged and have a limp. And so people don't realize how physically demanding wrestling is. Mm-hmm. And I went to probably the easiest school there ever was. Like, at the power plant, they cardioed you to death. You know, if you went to Ole Anderson or Gene Anderson's, they'd stretch the crap out of you. You know, and Larry didn't believe in that, and I'm glad he didn't, because I wouldn't have, I guess I would have stuck it out, but I mean, who knows? But I mean, that's not the way for me to physically learn, you know. I'm not going to learn any better by you beating me up and making me, you know, I got enough respect for the business that I'm going to learn it because I'm going to work hard at it. You can't force someone to learn just by beating them up. You know, I understand that you're going to weed out the people who don't really want it, except that you're going to weed them out anyway. You know, or at least back in the day when there were territories, they got weeded out right away because the people that didn't have the balls to suck it up, you know, working territories away from home, they quit anyway. So maybe in this day and age, you got to, you know, but back then, I never got that whole thing, beat the guys up, you know what I mean? Make them respect it. All it does is make them miserable and bitter, you know?
Yes. So,
although I do enjoy ribbing under, like, green guys. Not ribbing them. I just think the green guys, like, I think they should, like, you know, I don't have a problem with, you know, making them do all the driving, making them carry the bag, stuff like that, because, I mean, that's just paying your dues, you know? So I think there's a certain level of, servitude, you know? Yeah. That the green guys, you know, the up and comers should do, and I think that's a good thing, because, you know, and then of course, you know, like, it's amazing to meet all the green kids that complain, like, you know, about that, and like, I'm like, well, look, when you become a veteran and you can do it, you know, if you stick around long enough, then you can do it to other people. That's the way it works. It rolls downhill.
I mean, what sort of dues did you pay when you first started? Did
I don't know, not really. I mean, I don't know. It wasn't that tough, you know. I mean, or at least I didn't think it was. I mean, you know, you just. honestly, you don't pay a lot of dues if you respect the business, you know. Mm-hmm. I was a bit of a smart ass, so I had, you know, problems with some different people, and wasn't too popular for a long time, but yeah, that was my own fault. Also, some of the guys were, can I say dicks?
You can say whatever you want. Yes. It's a shoot.
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's going to air, but you know, a lot of guys were dicks, but ultimately, I mean, you know, if you respect the business, you know, and you want to learn, you're not going to have any problem from anybody. You know, that the guys who have the problems are the guys who don't respect the business.
So basically, you don't agree with the sort of mentality, you know, the old school mentality of, you know, making someone, you know, protect the business for the first couple of months and then kind of beat them up a bit and make sure they come back and come back and come back.
No, you know, I don't see the point. I just moved around. Am I off camera now?
No, you're fine.
All right. Because my neck's pretty bad off, and my neck and shoulder. So, like, I got to keep readjusting so I...
Okay.
And then I'd hate to have to film this again when the camera's got, you know, when I'm over here and you got half my head in the shot.
That's off your head, yeah.
All right.
That's fine.
I don't know. I don't see the point of beating the guys up, you know what I mean? I think that's just more of a sadistic streak and the guys have a heart on it, they want to get off on, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So how would you sort of weed someone out, you know, because there can be a lot of people that come in and, you know, they sort of...
They're going to weed themselves out. You got to have heart, you got to have stick-to-itiveness, you got to have discipline. You know, the guys that don't really want it, they're going to get weeded out anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not going to want to, you know, drive and fly. And, you know, when you start out now, there's no territories. Which, if there were, that weeds guys out right away. Because they're like, well, I don't want to move away from home and live in a territory and make a couple hundred bucks a week and drive a couple thousand miles. But, I mean, so that weeded guys out quick. But now, with the indie circuit, you know, unless you're a gazzed-up juice monkey... you know, it's very hard to get a break with the WWE, you know, or TNA. So, you know, you gotta drive, you know, like I wrestled these guys in Germany. They drove 1,000 miles or 1,000 kilometers to be at the show. You know what I mean? Like, you gotta put the you're gonna weed yourself out because you gotta put a lot of miles and time and effort into this to get to the next level.
Uh-huh.
You know, and the only exceptions to that are the guys that are just really jacked up, and now there's a complete lack of up and coming. Jacked up guys, you know what I mean? Big muscle bound guys. Like, if you go to the indies, it's all smaller guys now, you know what I mean? Whereas, you know, 5 years ago or 10 years ago, it was all everybody wanted to be the road warriors.
Yeah.
Now everybody wants to be a high flyer, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So, how would, do you think, would, as training, like, a training to be a wrestler, has it changed since with the new styles of wrestling and things coming? It was big guys before in the 80s when you were training, and now it's a lot more smaller, it's more fast paced style. Do you think they're being trained any differently to the way you were being trained?
Yeah. First of all, slide over a little bit that way because it's kind of weird for me looking over there to talk to you, and then there's a camera over here. There you go. All right, that's fine. I feel like I'm looking over here to talk to you, listen to you, and then I go to the camera. Like
my
that.
Apologies.
Anyway, oh, it's all right. Cheers, mate. I picked that up here. What was the question?
With a new kind of style.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, because now every fly-by-night ex-wrestler has a school. You know, so it's so easy to get trained by some guy who was never anybody to begin with. So he doesn't know anything. You know, he can't train you well. That's a huge problem. The biggest problem, and I wrote about this in my website, and not that I'm plugging it, but if you want to read about stuff like this, if you find this interesting, go to theraveneffect.com because I write about a lot of this stuff. And is the whole generation grew up wanting to be Shawn Michaels. And Shawn Michaels is brilliant. The problem is all they saw was the high flying. They didn't see the psychology, they didn't see the selling, and they didn't see the interviews. So, I mean, they did, but they didn't realize they were seeing it. So they said, oh, I want to do all these high flying things, which is great, except that there's no story, there's no drama. And the single most important thing in wrestling is the selling, and it's not happening, you know. And so what you have is a bunch of wannabes. And when they go out there, if you watch it, it looks like a bunch of guys playing wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't look like wrestlers. It looks like guys playing wrestling. And in the old days, you had to learn to sell in psychology because some old timer would beat you up if you didn't sell. Which then I think it's appropriate. You know what I mean? If you're not selling, you know, you get stiff. You know what I mean? And also in the old days, you went to a territory. And so obviously, if you weren't that good, they would put somebody who could work with you so you could learn. But now all this is a bunch of indie guys fighting a bunch of indie guys on the indie circuit. And so you got these high flying guys wrestling other high flying guys, and they're going, let's do that, let's do this. I saw that in the tape, let's do that. Which in context is all well and good, except they're so far out of context that it's pathetic. I mean, when I started, when I got to Portland and I became friends with the Booker and I became the top draw there in Portland, like my second year in the business, I wanted to do a lot of stuff like that. I wanted to be in cage matches. So I got him to, but he wouldn't just put me in a cage match, you know, because it didn't make any sense. He'd go, why should we put you in a cage match? I go, well, because I want to be in one. He's like, well, that's not a good answer. He's like, if we book you in a cage, why would we book you in a cage? I go, well, I guess because, let's say, because I was the heel, I said, you know, he's trying to get a hold of me and I keep, you know, running away so he can't ever catch me. So we put me to put it in a cage so that I can't get away. He's like, all right, good. I said, cool, let's do it. He goes, well, no, what are we going to do the week after? I was like, I don't know. It's like, well, tell me what you're going to do the week after so we have a story. So it's episodic story. So it makes sense. These guys just go, hey, let's have a cage match. Okay, we'll have a cage match for no reason. Hey, let's do this. Okay. You know, I wanted to do it. I always loved, I don't know where I got this from, but I always wanted to do a wedding angle. You know, I wanted to dump it abroad at the altar. And I just thought it was great heat. You know, what a heel, you know what I mean? And we built, and so... We didn't just have a wedding angle. We didn't just one day say, all right, let's get married, you know. We built that thing, and that was one of my proudest, that's actually one of my proudest storylines. We had a girl, Ginger, who was my valet. And I actually, when I got to Portland, the way I got over, part of the way I got over was every week I'd bring a different girl with me. And I was new to the territory, and Piper gave me 3 weeks to get over. And so obviously, you know, if you got a broad with you, you know, that just helps the thing. This was before everybody and her mother had a broad. Very few people had a broad. So, I bring a different broad every week, except and then it got to be hard because half the time they show up late, they didn't know where to go. So one night I was looking for a broad for the next week, and I was at my coke dealer's house, and there was this girl, Ginger, with big boobs, who was smoking crack, and she was hot. So I was like, hey, you want to be on TV tomorrow? She's like, yeah. So she showed up, and she actually was like the most punctual. She showed up on time. She was really good. So I made her my valet. You know, that was back when I had a drug problem. I don't anymore, but as oh, great stories about that. But So I made her my valet, and then every week she'd come to the ring with me, and we built up this long thing. And then while this is going on, I'm thinking, yeah, I want to do this wedding angle. So I thought, all right, how do we do this? How do we tell this story so I get maximum heat? And I'd been feuding with Steve Dahl, who was like the pretty boy babyface. I was the pretty boy heel. I used to actually be good looking back in the day, but that was a long time ago when I was good looking. And we brought in another valet because eventually after the broad turns, after I dumped the broad at the altar, she goes to the baby face, and then we're going to have the girl, you know, the mixed tag feud, guy and girl versus guy and girl. And so we brought in this girl, Robin, her ring name, I named her Veronica because she looked kind of like snooty and like, you know, like a Veronica, you know what I mean? And in fact, I think we never gave either one of them last names. But anyway, so... The way we set up the story, if I remember correctly, was I put up Ginger in a match, and then I lost her. And I lost her in a match, so I was crestfallen. So then I challenged Steve Dahl to another match, and if I somehow I got him to go along with it, that if I beat him, I'd get her back, and if he beat me, he'd get something else. I forget what it was. And so I beat him, but she wouldn't come back. So now I'm like, oh. So then I get a new valet. And the new valet comes in, I'm saying, hey, listen, you can be my valet, but we're not gonna fool around. And I remember I actually used the term no hanky panky, which is just so ridiculous. It's a horrible term. And which I said intentionally, because it's such a horrible term. And I said, we're not gonna fool around, no hanky panky. I said, because, you know, I'm still in love with somebody else. And so she was like, well, okay, but, you know, I really like you. So I got my valet who wants to do me, you know, and I wanna get back with my old valet now who's a baby face, and I'm a heel. So the next week I come out and I bring her some flowers. And then the next week I come out and what did I bring her? I brought her a plane ticket so we could go to Cancun. The next week I brought her something else. And so we built this story up. And eventually we built it up to the point where I would come down. And the best part was I would come down to the ring. And so the baby face, my arch enemy, Steve Dahl, would think I was going to attack him or cheap him. But I would just give her the roses and leave. So it's kind of, ooh, what's, you know, this is kind of interesting because he must really like her because he's not attacking the guy. He just wants to give her the flowers. Eventually, I sung to her, and I have like the world's worst singing voice, and I got like the Banaka spread, like, me, 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 me. And super hilarious stuff. And I sung so badly. It was so embarrassing to watch that people thought this must be real because no one would humiliate themselves that bad. And then we timed the angle out so that we would get the wedding. And then the next week, I was getting ready to propose to her. I got on one knee, so is he going to propose to her? And I got attacked. Then because I attacked the guy earlier in the show, so he came back and got me there. The next week I proposed, I got down on one knee and I proposed, you know, I love you, will you marry me? And she's like, let me think about it, I'll let you know next week. You know, so we kept every week, just keep tying a little more into the story, and you're just sucked in. Instead of just doing it all in 3 weeks, I mean, this was built over months, you know, where, I mean, the tension was just phenomenal. And then finally, so the next week she comes back and she goes, yes, I'll marry you. I said, oh, so I was, you know, I got up and I hug her. She's like, can we do it on, and I was like, I said, let's do it here on TV. I said, she goes, all right, but let's make it next week. So we built it up so that it was the week before Christmas that we were doing it. And because then I dump her at Christmas time. It's just, you know, it's so heelish. So the week before, and Christmas was always one of the biggest wrestling shows of the year. Christmas and Thanksgiving were two of the best nights for wrestling, and they don't even run on those nights anymore. But back then, back in the day, those were the best nights. People would, you know, like on Christmas, they'd open their presents and come to the show that night. So what happened was, so we had the big wedding set up, and we had the preacher in the ring, and then all the boys came out. And then, and along the way, now to add even more to this, now I got the female valet. And so one week I gave I gave Ginger the baby face, I gave her a stuffed animal. So Veronica stole the stuffed animal from her. And she's like, this was meant for me, give it back to me. So they would get like, you know, they would almost catfight a little bit between them, you know, and then I would have to go break it up. I was like, no, Veronica, I'm in love with Ginger, you know, you leave her alone. And it's, you know, just she'd be crying. And then of course, when she found out I proposed, she was like, I can't believe it. Why does he want to marry that fat cow? Why doesn't he want love? Why does he love me? So you got these, so me humiliating myself and my love for Ginger, Veronica humiliating herself and her love for me. And it's just, you know, you're sucked in. It's, you know, and it's convincing. And so we finally build the thing up. So it's the week before Christmas, and we have the big wedding set up. And so they play the wedding thing, and she comes down, and they play my music. And instead of me going to the ring, I go up to the interview area, to Crow's Nest, and I cut a promo. I was like, "Oh, you stupid fat cow! I'd never marry you. You know, I bought the plane tickets. I took them back and got my money back. The flowers I stole from Mr. McDougal's yard. I didn't even buy them." You know, whatever else I did, when I sang to you and told you I loved you, I didn't mean it. You know, I said, I wouldn't want you. I said, if I was going to have any girl, I'd want her to be Veronica. So I have her come out. And I got on like either I had it on or I gave it to her to wear. I had like a Santa Claus hat just to rub in the festive, you know, the festive season. The little things. Little things are so important. I mean, so I put the Christmas hat on her, the Santa Claus hat. So she comes out, I put my arm around her. I said, I wouldn't marry anybody, but if I was going to marry anybody, it'd be somebody like this, not Ginger. And Ginger's in the ring crying, you know what I mean? And everyone's like, oh my God. And, you know, it was heartbreaking. And this is how I know how, this is why I know how well that people actually believed and thought that was a shoot. Because the night before the episode when we were going to get married, I was at a nightclub. And this girl comes up to me in a bar, and she's like, and Portland wrestling was huge. I mean, it was the best, highest rated show in its time slot, which was 11 to 12:30 Saturday night. You know, going against Saturday Night Live, it would beat out Saturday Night Live every week. And this girl comes up to me, and she's like, you know, and I saw Scotty the Body back then. She goes, oh, Scotty. She goes, man, she's like, I can't believe you're getting married. She goes, oh, I love you. She goes, I'm like such a big fan of yours. She goes, and this wasn't like just some rat at the show. This was a girl in a bar. She's like, listen, she goes, I don't want to sound forward. She goes, I have to sleep with you before you get married. So I took her home and slept with her. And basically, I got laid just because the girl thought I was going to marry somebody else. So here we go. So I dump her at the altar. Then later on in the show, after I dump her, you know, Steve Dahl, who's the baby face who she's with now, he comes out and attacks me. But somehow I get the upper hand, and I end up pile driving him off the top rope. He was sitting, like I was standing on a second, and which was, you know, that's 15 years later. I mean, I'm sure it's not as big a move, but it was a pretty big move. It's still a big move, you know, me standing up on a second, pile driving him into the ring. And I think his head squished my balls. It's really ow. Actually probably hurt me more than him. Anyway, so he did the shake, you know, and so they stretchered him off, and we both cut some promos, and then this was 2 weeks before Christmas, 2 weeks before Christmas. So then we cut promos for the week before Christmas, and then because we both took the week off for the holiday, you know, for that, and then Christmas Day we came back for the big show, and it was like one of the biggest houses ever, and of course we had this huge monumental match, and then eventually we split off in a mixed tag, and the whole thing was, Although the irony is, we split off into the mixed tag, and the girls couldn't get along, and the girls kept shooting on each other in the ring, and we never stopped them. So they eventually kicked us out of our own angle. After all that, after like 4 months of buildup, after the hottest angle in the company, probably in like 5 or 10 years, and they kicked me and Dahl out of the angle because we let the girls shoot every night. So they put Art Barr and the Beetlejuice and Al Madrilla in it, which of course then it went, because that's not what the people wanted, you know. But my whole point is, in this long story, is you can't just do stuff to do stuff. You have to build it, you have to tell a story. Because if you don't hook them dramatically, all the athleticism in the world, they're never gonna buy a ticket, you know. Athleticism's great, but you can only watch so many flippity-floppity high-spot Couture matches, you know, with the cruiserweights go woo-woo-woo, which I enjoy that. I enjoy it once a night. I don't enjoy seeing it twice or three times, because then it's just a bunch of guys doing moves. And as acrobatic as it is, it's not really, there's no drama to it, because they don't know when to sell. They don't know how to pace it. The pace never changes. They go at one speed. So the whole thing is, what's so important is telling a story. And there's nothing better than episodic. And that's why I never really go to Japan, because the story isn't as important there. They're more just having matches. That's not for me. That's why I love TNA, because it's a weekly story. That's why I loved ECW or WCW or WWE. Every week it's a story, and every week has repercussions on the next week. And if it's done right, the viewers get something so special. And that's why I hate when there's continuity problems, when bookers would go, they're just a bunch of fans, but just a bunch of marks, you know, we can do anything we want. No, you can't. Because the people have invested interest. I used to hate when I would watch a story and then something would happen that made no sense. Kind of like when me and Dahl got kicked out of the angle. Because people are like, why would that happen? You know what I mean? They don't know the girls are shooting. You know, made for good wrestling.
So basically, you know, just then, you one of your storylines, you know, you have so many good ideas, you know, and how to go into storylines. Did you pick that up from anyone? I mean, you obviously have a very imagination.
That's what I'm saying. I rode with the Grappler.
Yeah.
He was the booker in Portland. And the Grappler was working on top for Watts when he was like 20, you know, which is a pretty big deal, you know, because usually back in the day, it would take you 5 years to get up on top, you know, to get to a good spot. 5 years minimum, 5 to 10 years was a standard. You know, I was working on top after a year in Portland. Grappler is probably the same when he was 20 back in for Watts. And he had a really good mind for the business, you know. Bit of an underachiever. Also, I think he was like 5'8", 5'9", no stocky, but he still, you know, his height hurt him. But I think he was an underachiever because I think he could have done more, you know what I mean? But he was a phenomenal mask man. And to be a mask man, you have to be so much more visually expressive with your body because there's no facials. Although if you watch the cruiserweights, they have no facials anyway, which blows my mind, because if you have your face and that's your most, that's where you can show the most emotion, anger, hatred, fear, humor, love, whatever, you know what I mean? And the cruiserweights, they just have one blank space because they're just thinking, okay, what's the next flippity flopper spot? But I've always been extremely creative, and I finally found my calling for my creativity in wrestling. And in riding with the Grappler, he taught me, I had to pick his brain. It's not like he pulled me aside and said, I'm going to teach you, which I really wish somebody would have done that, but nobody ever did that for me. And that's why I do it for guys like Punk and AJ, because no one did it for me. I pull him aside and I go, okay, this, and this, and I tell him and I try and teach him. And but the Grappler was a huge influence because I learned so much picking his brain, because I used to ride with him every night. You know, every night, and that's another thing now is in the States, in the business, basically you get on a plane, you fly to the next town, you know what I mean? You don't drive anymore, and so much of wrestling, so much of the teaching of wrestling was learned in the car, because you would drive, and like now there's just such a hierarchy, like the top guys are always with the top guys, bottom guys bottom, middle guys middle. So you're not riding or hanging with anybody above you that you can learn from. So, you know, I was fresh, I was only in the business a year, and even though I was on top, you know, I mean, it wouldn't have made a difference. I made friends with the Grappler, you know, not intentionally, but it worked out that way. So, you know, he's the booker, so I would ride with him, and we'd drink a 12-pack on the ride home every night, and you would talk about it, and he would say, okay, I go, what'd I do wrong? Well, you did this. I go, what could I have done different? This. I'd go, why? Some old-timers get mad when you say why, because like, what, are you questioning me? I'm like, well, no, I'm not questioning you, but if I don't know why I'm doing something, obviously it's not gonna work every single occasion. So I need to know why I'm doing it, so when it does apply, I'll know, and when it doesn't, I can do something else. And I really learned a lot there. In Florida before that, Mike Graham taught me some stuff, except I didn't understand it at the time. Like, I remember running into Mike, and Mike had a great mind. I remember running into Mike years later in WCW, and I was like, now I get what you're saying. Like, he gave me some advice, a couple different things, and just, you know, I was like, old timer, I don't know what they're talking about. Because it's the same thing that young kids, not all of them, but a few of them will say to me today, like, well, they won't say it to my face because they respect me, but behind my back, I know they're going, just old timer, he's whatever. But you can't understand it at that stage, because Mike taught me stuff that I was like, and then like 5 years later, I'm like, Mike, that was so brilliant. I wish I understood what the hell you were talking about at the time, because now I get it. You know what I mean?
Definitely. So you just mentioned earlier, you touched upon you kind of teach AJ Styles and CM Punk. You're showing them like a better way, you know, teach them about the business. Who do you think you've had the most influence on in the business?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, Saturn I had a lot of influence on. Saturn's got a really good mind, too. Canyon, a little bit. You know, I mean, he wants to do his own thing. But, you know, I had some influence on Canyon. Punk, AJ, who else? A lot of people. I mean, I'm very opinionated. That's why I rub a lot of people the wrong way, because I'll just go up to them and tell them, hey, I enjoyed the match, or I thought you worked hard, but this didn't work, that didn't work. And most guys don't want to hear that. You know, they just, you know, they go, hey, how's my match? Well, I'll tell you. I go, this is what I say now is, they go, what do you think of my match? I go, do you really want me to tell you, or do you just want me to put you over? And so they go, no, I want you to tell me, so I'll tell them. And then, you know, later on you find out half of them really wanted you to just put them over, you know.
Now, can you basically take me, you know, if you a match that's been done recently, you know, you've taken these guys aside and told them what they've done and did wrong, on an indie show, let's say NWA TNA, have you ever, like, recently taken two guys aside that have had a match and basically, what have you said to them?
I do it all the time. I do it every week.
Can you give me an example of a match, maybe?
Sure.
And what was wrong with it and what was right?
Oh, I just give you the other night in FWA, here in England, me and Punk worked, and I thought it was a really good match, but it, a couple things. And, and this I told Alex this too, the finish was me putting Punk over. And, which I have no problem with, so I didn't say a word. I was like, all right, it's cool. Because, you know, I'm never going to be a prima donna in politic a finish. But I did know, just from knowing the business, that when you bring somebody in, like, especially where they've never been before, I've never been to England, and the fans were like, I was the main draw on the card, and the main reason the fans were coming was to see me. They don't want to see the guy they came to see lose, at least not the first time. You know, maybe if he's going to be in a storyline. But I wasn't gonna politic and say, I need to go over, because it doesn't come across right. But when it was over, I was like, you could tell by the finish that they weren't happy, and that affects the rest of the show. It also affects future performances. It's not that important on a grand scale the one time. But I said, make sure when you bring stars in, you put them over, you know, at least the first time. And I understood Alex's psychology. He was thinking, well, I'm going to Germany the next day, and Punk's got two more shows in England, so if he loses the first night, and then he's got a challenge for the title, it kind of hurts him. I understand that. But in the grand scheme of things, it would have been more important to put Raven over, you know, not me, but Raven, you know, the character over. It would have been more important to put him over just because that's what they wanted to see. Another mistake I made was, I wanted to work extra hard because, you know, I hadn't been to England in 15 years and I'd never been as Raven, and I really wanted to, you know, work hard for the people, you know. I should have went half as long. First of all, it was a long card. It was way too long a card, which I pulled aside Alex and told him, you can't run a 4-hour show. Gabe Sapolsky does it all the time, and it burns the crowd out. And when by the time the main event gets on, the people are too tired to scream, and it makes your main event look like nobody cares, you know. The people have about 2.5 hours in them, maybe three, you know. WrestleMania's a little different, which was 5 hours, but that's completely different. But for your basic, they got about 2.5 hours, three at the most. After that, they're running, they're having to fight to stay where they need to be, as opposed to being up for everything. Now they have to force themselves to be up because they want to be up. They just don't have it, you know, you only have that much energy in you. And also the crowds don't know how to pace themselves, so they may get a little giddy over the first couple matches just because it started the show and burn out a lot of energy. In fact, we used to tease that we were going to, me and Jonathan Boyd, when I was in Portland, we used to teach kid that we were going to have a class for the marks to teach them how to pace themselves, you know, so they can, you know, when to applaud, when to start chants, you know, when to, how to pace yourself so you save your energy for the main event. But I wanted to work so hard for the people coming to England. And so we put 30 minutes in, you know, from the time we went out to the time we came back. And I noticed, and this is one of the problems with today's guys, is they don't listen to the crowd. I listen to the crowd. That's the most important thing you can do. And the crowd was louder at the halfway mark than they were at the end. Basically, I should have went with a 15-minute match. And what I wanted to do was I got two sets of heat, basically. Got a set of heat on me. I made a big comeback. One of the false finishes. Then we went out into the crowd. And then we got a whole nother set of heat going and a second comeback. And by the time we started the second heat, I realized the crowd was, not that we lost them, but if they were on a level 9 before, now they were at an 8.5 or a 7, 7.5, 8, you know what I mean? Which you never want to end lower than you start. You want to start hot, and then you want to settle it down, and you want to build up to there. And the highest point, the loudest point of the match should be the end of the match. And I misjudged the crowd, but at that point, I couldn't do anything about it because he'd already got the second set of heat, so we still had it like, you know, we could have got out of the match there, but that wouldn't have helped matters. So we just went ahead, and I just figured the best thing we could have done was just do what we did and went ahead and did the comeback. But I called most of the entire match in the ring, which I preferred doing as well, because then I can judge the crowd. And you know, I mean, you misjudge it sometimes. I wanted to work extra hard, and I think it would have been, to make that match a perfect match, or, you know, as best as it could have been. And here's the thing, I thought it was a really good match. I was really happy with it. It was a really strong 30 minutes. But length isn't always the most important thing, you know, width is. No, that's a whole other thing. Length isn't always the most important thing, and I think if I, you know, and being a perfectionist, to make that match as best as I could, what I would have done was I would have kept the first heat a little longer and just made the one comeback and only went about 15, 18, maybe 20 minutes total. And I also would have put Raven over. And there was a couple spots in there that I went over with Punk that we could have done a little differently. A few things got a little sloppy accidentally. But I thought overall, like, he did a really good job, you know. Like, one of the things I used to always have to remind him was, whenever you get the heat going, he's the heel, he gets a good set of heat on me. I'd get one big hope spot, boom, I'd go down selling. And he would always wait for me to come to him, which really hurts the match, because if he's beating me up for 4 minutes, 4 or 5 minutes, and I do one move, how am I gonna get up first? Like, and Punk would say, but it was such a big move. I go, yeah, Punk, but cumulatively, you've beaten me up for 4 or 5 minutes. So that's desperation. I got one move. All you took was one move in the last 5 minutes. Always beat me to your feet. You have to. Otherwise, what happens is I come to you, and then if you stop me, I look like an idiot because you out-wrestled me. And I don't want to make the comeback that soon. And if I come to you, I got to start fighting, you know, because I can't just come to you and just go hit me, you know what I mean? So I got to make another little rally, which I don't want to do there. And it was like week after week, I was like, come on, Punk, you got to come to me first. And it finally sunk in, you know what I mean? He's a good student. I think the best student is AJ, because AJ, I'll tell him something one time, and the next match he'll do it, you know what I mean? A lot of guys, you know, it's hard to always correct stuff because you have certain habits. And, you know, you would think that somebody would just tell you something, you know, they're right, you would just fix it. But, you know, it's not that easy because you're ingrained to do things a certain way because you've been doing them for so long, you know? I got to take a pause here and go to the bathroom.
Okay, sure.
Look forward to meeting you somewhere down the line, but...
Okay, Raven, one of the traits you're most famous for in wrestling are your promos. What goes through your mind as you put together a promo? I mean, do you think them up on the spot? Do you usually plan a promo?
No, you know, like, then nobody ever tells you what you're doing on the show until you get there. So, which people probably think, like, if they didn't know, they probably think, oh, like a week ahead to tell you. But the reason no one's ever told what they're doing coming up is because invariably guys are going to have to put people over, do stuff they don't want to do. So if you tell them, you know, beforehand, and they got all that week, let's say you tell them 3 days ahead of time, then they have 3 days to think about it, get pissed off, obsess about it, complain, cry, bitch. You know, it doesn't do anybody any good. So the best thing you do is you don't tell anybody. When they get to the show, you let them find out, and you worry about it then. Because I've always had a hand in writing my own stuff, I've always kind of known what I was doing, you know. Like, even when I was in WCW, the second time, not Scotty Flamingo, but as Raven, Bischoff let me write my own storylines, which was huge because only Hulk got to write his own storylines. Unfortunately, what would happen is Sullivan and Terry Taylor didn't like that I was getting to write my own stuff, so they would try and change it, which I don't have a problem with somebody changing it and making it better, but they would just change it just to screw with it, you know, just because they were, Sullivan was just pissed that I was getting to do my own stuff. But so for the most part, I've always kind of known what I'm doing. In ECW, I kind of had a hand in my own stuff too, so I knew what I was doing. So I'm the exception, not the rule. But TNA, I don't know. You know, I find out when I get there if I got a promo or not. And usually when I get a promo, I mean, well, if I think of something clever, I'll write it down. And I got like I got notebooks filled with clever stuff, or at least I think it's clever. And I think clever is the key. If you can cut a promo and the guy in the front row could say the exact same thing, you know, because it's that easy to come up with, then you didn't cut a very good promo. You know, let alone whether you have any intensity or believability factor. You know, like, if you're just cutting some just, let me tell you something, I'm going to kick your butt. I mean, that's pretty bland and generic. If it's that, you know, it shouldn't be. It should have some flavor, some style. And so I write stuff down. And so what I'll do is, they say, all right, you got a promo. I'll look through my stuff and I'll think, ooh, I'd like to use this line today. And I'll find some line, some clever line that I came up with, or I read somewhere, I wrote it down. You know, there's a British comic book author, Warren Ellis, just brilliant, just writes the most mad, crazy stuff. And every so often, I'll something that he wrote, I'll write it down, you know, and I'll use that, or I'll change, you know, some of the words, but the thought will be the same. Which actually, I got the idea of taking stuff from other people, from Jake Roberts. Jake Roberts used to like read song lyrics, and that's where he'd get a lot of his material from. And you could call it plagiarism, but I think imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. But I'll pick a line and I'll go, oh, I like this line, I want to get this in, and then I'll build a promo around that line. You know, like if I got to get, they'll say, the office will say, we need you to say this. This has to be covered. Then I'll read, then I'll look through my stuff and go, oh, this applies to that. And I get my clever little thing, and then I'll take those two bits of information and I'll build the whole thing together. And the hard part is, like, it's very hard to talk in, I call it Ravenese, where that pseudo mystical mumbo jumbo, you know, it's very hard. Like, I can't come up with that off the top of my head. You know, I can't just, I mean, I can a little bit, but I can't just, you know, some things in life, sometimes in life we make our own choices. Sometimes in life a choice is made for us, and sometimes there is no choice. And you're going to give somebody watching that camera a headache the way you keep moving it around. But anyway, I don't care, but I've watched stuff with a camcorder and you're like, you get seasick. Anyway, so hold it still. Stuff like that, like, you don't just come up with on the top of your head, so I got to, you know, put a little effort, I got to write things out. And after doing it for so many years, I don't want to prepare. Like, I like when I don't prepare at all. I like to just go out there and just think off the top of my head, because it's more challenging, you know what I mean? And I like that. And that's the kind of rush I'm getting. So I'm trying to get away from the Ravenese now and speak more like how I normally speak, which is how you're hearing. Which is also why I'm a good commentator, because I'm very quick. You know, I'm very quick-witted. I'm very clever on my feet, which is, you know, why most people can't be commentators, you know, because there's a lot of great promo men that can't commentate for crap because they can't think on their feet. They need to have time to prepare, you know. I've never needed any time to prepare except when I'm talking in Ravenese. But does that answer your question?
That does. Thank you very much. Nowadays, you know, there's a more like wrestling-based style coming out, and you know, you can see it on TV now. You know, there's more wrestling and things. Do you think promos are just as important nowadays?
Absolutely. The whole object of a promo is you're talking to people into the seats. If you're a babyface, you want to make them believe that you're going to get the revenge, or you're going to do something. If you're the heel, you want to make them hate you so bad that they're paying to see you get your ass kicked. I mean, that's what it boils down to. You're paying, as the fan, you're either paying to see the heel get his ass kicked or the babyface kick his ass, or both. And that's why if the fans don't love you or hate you, you're never going to be a big draw or a big star. If they just like you or dislike you, there's not enough visceral emotional connection. And yeah, the promos, I'll give you a great example. Like, all right, Benoit. Benoit's a phenomenal wrestler. The reason he's never been given the ball before is because his promos aren't main event level. You know, maybe now that they've given him the belt, maybe he's going to step up to the plate. You know, maybe he had it in him all along. who knows? The point is if you can't talk, after a while, the people are like, you know, it's easy for me to say that, but I've seen it. It's hard for someone who's a big fan of some guy who's a really good wrestler to go, bullshit. You know what I mean? You know, but it's true. And they go, oh, they just don't want to push so-and-so. Well, no, there's a reason. It's, you know, time-tested, you know, methods of finding this out, you know. And you don't have to be a good worker to draw money. You know, Dusty Rhodes was never going to be considered a great worker, but he could go out there, have a lousy main event, and you'd be like, I'm never buying another ticket. Then you watch the show on Saturday, and he would talk you right back into the seat. You're like, I'm going to see that. I'm going to see the American Dream. And your friend would say, didn't he just have a lousy match? Oh, who cares? This week's going to be great, man. I heard him talk. I believe it, you know? That's, you know, Hogan, same thing. You know, when you have somebody like an Austin or a Rock who can talk and work, that's the best. But the work is the least important thing. In fact, I think one of the, when the WWE, when Scott Steiner came in, when I was there, Big Papa Pump, he came in and we worked a show in Hawaii. And it was one of the loudest pops I've heard in the entire year I was there. And I was like, man, this guy's definitely going to do business with him. And then what they did was they exposed him. They took him 25 minutes. And people go, oh, he's not really that good a worker. You know, he can't move anymore. His body's too beat up. And so he did never really get over it. And see, back in the old days, what it was you didn't overexpose somebody. Why should you? That's not about business. That's politics. For business, you don't expose somebody who can't work. You work around them. That's why the good workers always carry the bad workers. Because Steiner's promos and his character, he made you want to come see him. He did. You know, and they killed that. They efficiently killed that off. But, you know, for anybody who says that work rate is still that important, they're absolutely wrong. And I'm sure John Cena is going to prove that because he's not a great worker by any stretch of the imagination. You know, but he's going to talk him into the seats. And you got to remember, I mean, Nikita Koloff wasn't a great worker, but you wanted to see him. You talk the people into the seats. It's that simple.
Do you think there's anyone around the circuit in the US these days that, you know, although they're like a great worker, they just don't have the sort of mic work. They're being pushed, but they're not. They don't have that sort of skill to take it to the next level. But they. Do you know what I mean?
Something, give me an example.
You mentioned Benoit. Now, you know, he's a great worker, and right. Things, but his promos, you know, from my personal opinion, I'm sorry, but they're not as good as I think they
right,
for
sure.
A main event.
That's what everybody
be.
Thought, yeah.
Do you think that there's someone like that now that is getting a push in the US circuit that, you know, maybe shouldn't be just yet? They need to have a bit more work done on like their promos.
No, because nobody's really getting a push. Yeah, you know, that's the whole problem with the American business is Nobody's getting pushed. I mean, that was the problem in WCW when they collapsed, was the same 10 guys were on top for forever and they wouldn't bring anybody else up into the main event. You know, me, Conan, Jericho. They wouldn't bring any of us up, wouldn't bring anybody else up, so the top got stagnant. WWE, same thing when I was there. Same guys fighting the same guys, the top got stagnant. That's why they had to bring Eddie and Chris up, and not that Eddie doesn't deserve it, and we'll see if Chris does. You know what I mean? Chris's ring work and his time in the business doesn't necessarily merit you a main event. It doesn't. I don't care how hard or how long you worked, it does not mean you deserve a main event. Now, and I never would have put the belt on him. That being said, when I was watching the match at WrestleMania, the crowd was so incredibly hot for him that if I was in the match and I was supposed to win, I would have called the audible and lost. He needed to win that match, and now we're going to see if he can carry the ball. So there are exceptions to the rule, certain crowds, like especially Madison Square Garden, where you got people flying in from all over the country who are more work rate inclined, going apeshit for him. You know what I mean? Any other arena, that wouldn't have happened. But that was the right arena with the right people at the right event that they had to put the belt on him. And if they wouldn't have, it would have been a huge mistake. And now we'll see if Christian carried the ball, which is a lot of times you got to put guys in a position. I've never been a big fan of putting the belt on him to put him in a position, but I would definitely put him in the main events. But in this case, I would. That's always been the problem. That's why the business is so cyclical. Because what happens is you get a couple guys over and they start drawing money because they can talk them into the seats. People come. And then eventually the people are going to get burned out on them, or they're going to get old, or something's going to happen. And you have to have a couple other guys coming up to take their place. And what happens is the top guys don't want anybody else taking their place because they don't want to lose their spot and lose all the money. So they keep everybody down. And what happens is they eventually burn themselves out. There's no one to replace them. And we have a down cycle. And you know, and that's what happened in WCW. That's what happened in WWE. And you know, I mean, it's you can look historically, and that's the way it's always been.
And you just mentioned how, you know, there is no one, there is no one is getting pushed at the moment. There is not much major promotions on television. You know, how do you feel?
I'll give you Jericho. I think even though they gave Jericho the world belt, they never really put the rocket up his ass. And I think Jericho could have been huge. I mean, I thought he could have been twice as big as he was. He had such a connection with the fans. I remember when I was there that he worked with Rock. And he was turned. They were both baby faces, I think. And Jericho was supposed to be turning heel, I think. And he ended up turning to Rock heel. And this was before the fans were turning to Rock heel because he was leaving all the time. Mm-hmm. This was when he was still over, because Jericho had such a phenomenal connection with the fans that even though he was starting to be heelish, they loved him more than Rock, because he had that phenomenal connection. And not that Rock didn't, but Rock did too. But they never really gave Jericho a chance. They put him with Stephanie, and then he had him walk the dog and kill the dog, and it stopped being about wrestling. And Jericho never really got the chance to really prove himself, and I thought he could have been a draw. You know, I thought he could have. I thought I could have. I'll give you another great example. Conan. Not going to be mistaken for a good worker by anyone, but one of the biggest draws in the history of Mexico. You know, and he could have been a huge draw in the States, like if they'd have given him the ball, because his promos, and he talked you into the seats, you know, phenomenal. You know, and I think now, like, he's beat up, he's old, he's not old, but he's beat up, he's older, he's tired, he's, you know, so now he's not even trying to improve his ring work. You know, now when ring work's more important, but, you know, if they were gonna give him a push, I guarantee, like, I know enough, like, me and him are close friends, I know enough that I could make you convinced that Conan is a really good worker. Because I could teach him how to hide his bad, his flaws, and how to accentuate his positives, and you would think, wow, Conan's really turned into a hell of a worker, you know? But he's almost like, you know, if they're not going to give him the push, then, you know, why even go to the effort, which I disagree with, but, you know, I can understand his point, you know what I mean? Plus, his hips bothered him or something, his shoulder, I don't know. But Conan's a great example of a guy who could, he will talk you into the seats. If you put him in a main event position, he'll talk you into the seats, and he's not going to have main event caliber, main event that you would think main event caliber matches, but you'll still pay to see him.
Okay. So can you give me a basic rundown of what, you know, you think it takes of someone to make it as a big star on TV, basically? You know, what do they need? What sort of qualities do they need to have?
You need to have, okay, you need to be able to talk. That's so important. You need to have charisma, which is the X factor. You know, some people have it, some don't. You need to be a personality. You know, not a gimmick, but very few gimmicks have ever actually worked. Like, the Undertaker gimmick worked, the Big Boss Man gimmick worked, but other than that, the guys who got over were personalities. You know, Flair was a personality, Funk's a personality, Bruno was a personality, Zbyszko when he was a draw was a personality, Raven's a personality. You know, these are real-life people. Rock, Austin, they're not gimmicks, you know what I mean? And I think that's where people make a mistake. They want to be a gimmick. You know, you have to be a person who's larger than life. Michael Hayes back in the day. I loved Michael Hayes. In fact, Scotty the Body was, I don't know if it was a homage, but like Michael Hayes was my hero. That's who I wanted to be. And one of my greatest moments in my career at that point was, long story short, basically I was at a club, I saw him there, and while I was deciding whether or not to be a mark and walk up and say, I'm a, you know, and bow at his feet, his wife came over and said, my husband wants to meet you. Michael Hayes called me over. And basically, his wife's like, oh, this is the guy you make me watch wrestling every day at 4 o'clock on ESPN for. And, you know, it was like the greatest compliment ever that Michael Hayes wanted to meet me. When I stole so much stuff from Michael Hayes, I was like, can you see how I do your stuff? He's like, no, I don't. I go, wow, that's an even bigger compliment. He goes, which I thought was an even bigger compliment, that I took his stuff and I made it my own so that he didn't even know I was stealing from him, you know, which is what you want to do. You want to make it your own. What was the question?
It's basically, what do you think it takes, you know, to make it a pro wrestler?
Oh, yeah, qualities? So charisma, interview skills, you know, you have to have a half-assed clue to psychology, you know what I mean? But even that, you can be carried by a guy, you know. I think to stay on top, you got to have a clue, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You have to have a clue. You don't have to be a great worker, but you have to have a clue to psychology, you know. The better the work rate, obviously, the better it is, but it's not mandatory. You know, Dusty proved that. Dusty had great psychology. Didn't have to be able to work. Plus, he could sell, you know. All you need is a baby face is two things. Selling and fire. It's all you need. You don't have to be able to do anything else except sell, get the people behind your selling, and you need to have fire and that comeback. That's it.
So who do you think that had all these, a person that had all these qualities that just didn't make it in the business, or, you know, didn't become a name that you thought they would be? Is there anyone that you think?
Well, no, I mean, with those skills always, you know, made it. You know, the talent always rises to the top. I mean, or, you know, or close to the top, you know, until they get, you know, the glass ceiling hits them in the head, you know what I mean? But, you know, I don't think there's anybody that never really, you know, at least got some, you know, like, I mean, if I said myself, but at ECW, I was the world champion. WCW, I was a featured player, you know. TNA, I'm the main event. So, I mean, you know, so I can't say myself, even though I never got my chance in WWE. But if you went by WWE, I never got my chance, you know, I think. Conan and Jericho never, like, the three of us never got the chance in WCW pass. We were all featured players in the show, but we didn't get to go to the main event, you know what I mean? So that, you know, but there's not a lot of them. You know, everybody thinks, oh, there's push this guy and push that guy. No, if it was that easy to get over, you know, we'd have much more guys being over. It's not. Most guys that the people want to push really aren't that over. Oh, RVD. RVD had this unique charisma and bond with the people that back when they were doing the Alliance thing, which was a ridiculous angle, if they'd have let Jericho fight Austin, I mean, not Jericho, I mean Van Damme, we'd have drawn big houses. The people loved Van Damme. And there was an example. His charisma was so unbelievable that his promos weren't good at all, but his charisma carried him anyway. Like, he had just such a weird, unique charisma that his anti-promo, you know, hey, stoner promo, it would have worked. Mm. I guarantee that would have made money. CM Punk. Oh, do I love beating up CM Punk. I could beat up CM Punk every single day of the week, and it would not be enough.
So here we are in merry old England. CM Punk, straight edge wrestling superstar.
I don't know why that is. Maybe it's the fact that I took him under my wing. Maybe it's the fact that every time I was teaching him, he thought he knew better. He thought he knew more.
You see, I believe in three things. No drugs, no alcohol, and no promiscuous sex. See, I'm a fine, upstanding individual.
But I love to slap him. I love the sound it makes when I put my hand across his cheek and then hear him scream like a schoolgirl with a skinned knee.
Tonight, I'm here to destroy Raven, and I'm here to destroy every single one of Raven's fans.
I'm gonna slap that bloody stupid toe rag so hard that he's gonna puke his guts up.
Drink up, England. I want your liver to fail.
And then I'm gonna stick my fist down his throat, I'm gonna pull out his intestines, and then I'm gonna feed him to him.
Smoke up, England. I want you to die.
CM Punk, I don't like you. I've never liked you.
Tonight, just like I did in America, I'm gonna dominate you, Raven.
You annoy me, you aggravate me.
And your time in FWA will be never more.
What a bonus it is. Besides getting to come to England, I get to beat you up. I think this is gonna be one hell of a trip.
So you can quote that, bitch.
Quote the Raven, nevermore.
Okay, we're back on Raven. The Wrestling Channel, this shooting video is being filmed for the Wrestling Channel. The FWA is part of the Wrestling Channel.
Sure.
5-year exclusive deal. You know, our guys, we haven't had TV in the country in many, many years. Basically, what kind of advice can you give to some of our younger British guys who are, you know, they're viewing the first time on TV about, you know, selling to cameras and things like that? What sort of advice can you give to television, to get ready for television, basically?
First of all, anything you film on TV, you got to make it a little tighter. It needs to be a little stiffer because the television is so close that you can see through the work. You know what I mean? So, you know, you have to tighten it up a little bit. You know, I would rather be stiffed on TV than make it look light. However, in a house show, I would much rather have it be light than be stiffed, you know, because you only have so much abuse your body can take. So, I don't get the whole Japan thing where, you know, like my friend, I showed my friend a tape, and he's like, I could do that. He goes, they're hitting each other for real. How? Where's the art in that? I mean, granted, you got to be a pretty tough guy to be hit for real, but there's no art form in it. The art of this business is make it look as believable as possible without hurting each other. You know, that's the art. But so I got off your question, but that's just a sore subject with me.
No, please.
Is guys that come in and like, oh, I want to be stiff and snug. No, there's no art form in stiff and snug. You know, not, I mean, the best workers you don't feel because they make it look stiff and snug without doing it. Except on TV where I think it should be tighter. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Our TV show is obviously going to be weekly. You know, basically this country, people say, put it into territories. England is basically the size of one territory. How do you think our weekly TV show should be done, you know, in terms of storylines and matches and things? How, if you were in charge of booking FWA TV weekly, how would you do it?
Well, I would fire you first. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, we need to, next time we need to get an audience so I can make people laugh with material, because you're not popping on my stuff. Okay.
It's very late.
What would I do? Well, I mean, obviously I would do the same. You know, what's most important is the stories. You know, you have to tell dramatic stories. You know, people, you know, I don't want to burst anybody's bubble, but wrestling's not a sport. It's a drama. I mean, it is a sport. Don't get me wrong. You have to be athletic. But you don't have to have a lick of athleticism to draw money, because this is a drama. You know, like I tell the guys, like, you know, I use Gladiator as a reference. I go, after your match, when you're all beat up, and the guy, like, you're all beat up and you barely win, and then the ref raises your hand, and you're like, hey, I won, yay, and you're jumping around. I was like, how believable would it be in Gladiator, if you went to see Gladiator with Russell Crowe, and he's all mangled up, and the guy, Joaquin Phoenix, you know, stabbed him with the knives, and he's all beat up. How would it be at the end of the thing if he just got up and was like, all right, yeah, and started playing to the crowd? No, it wouldn't work, because he's beat up, and you would go, oh, come on, he's hurt. And what wrestlers don't get, these stupid idiots coming up, is it's the same thing. This is a drama. If you don't act like you're hurt, the people can't tell if it hurts or not. So if you don't physically, they can't physically feel it. So if you don't show it, you know, they can hear it and they can see it. And if you don't, and that's why when, like, if you get a really good super kick where you slap your leg and it sounds like you really hit the guy, hold on, I dropped my water. And it sounds like you really hit the guy, the people really pop, because they go, ooh, because they think there might have been real contact. You know, the people are willing to suspend disbelief. They know it's a work, and they're going, okay, but we don't want to, they don't want you to rub it in their faces by, you know, so when you're all beat up and you're just, hey, look, I'm not hurt, well, that's rubbing it in their faces, and it takes them out of their mindset, and consciously they may not realize it, but subconsciously, they're like, this doesn't look right, you know what I mean, and it ruins so many matches, you know what I mean, and kills so much drama, and it hurts so many guys in the long run, because it's hard to get an emotional investment in somebody who's never hurt.
So,
where's the drama?
Definitely.
It's a drama. Uh-huh. You know, and stories need to be told. You know, you need to have angles, you know, and they have to make sense. They have to be logical and make sense. You have to have people talk. I think it's important to have people that aren't very good at it, to give them a couple opportunities, you know what I mean? Because that's the only way you're going to learn, and that's how you're going to find some diamonds in the rough, you know?
I mean, you mentioned earlier about, you know, basically selling the moves, you know, selling injuries and things like that. You, on your website, theraveneffect.com, you have a column about the psychology of selling. Mm. You know, what one of your matches would you say totally signifies that, the whole article?
Honestly, yeah, hopefully every match. I mean, my mission is selling. You know, that's my gospel. If I leave this business teaching people to sell better, I'll feel like I've done my job, you know. You're never going to see me win a match, you know, and get up perfectly fresh like the match just started, because it wouldn't make any sense, because I just went through a match. I'm going to be hurt. I'm going to be holding myself. I'm going to be like squinting, you know. It's so simple. It's what I like about selling is it's democratic. You don't have to have an ounce of athletic skill to be a good seller yet, because, you know, because, like, you have to be pretty athletic to do some kind of moonsaults and flippity floppity stuff. But you don't have to have any athleticism to be a good seller, you know. So everybody can do it, and it's the most important thing. So that's why it's democratic. And the irony is, it's the most important thing, and it's the thing anybody can do, and yet it's the thing that people do the worst and the least of.
Okay. Who do you think, you know, needs to work on their selling in the business today?
Everybody.
Everybody.
Just about. Most everybody. It's amazing how bad people are selling, and the worst people these days, you know, are the young guys coming up, because, like I said, it's like the Shawn Michaels thing earlier, they want to be like Shawn, but they don't see what he does, they don't see the selling and the psychology. Yeah. All they see is a bunch of crazy moves, and they never go back to, like, they think that once the guy stops beating on them and they get offensive, it's their turn, so they act like they're not hurt at all. It's dumb. And I've seen guys actually do this, physically get hurt and act like they weren't hurt. Does that make any sense? They, for a shoot, get hurt, and they come back limping, and they weren't limping. I go, why weren't you limping out there? They go, I don't want to show it. That's the whole point, is you want people to think you're hurt, you moron. Here you hurt yourself legitimately and you're covered up. That's the most idiotic thing I've ever seen.
If you could take one person, like, in the industry today, and basically someone you feel you could take under your wing, you'd really like to see take under your wing and teach them all these things, who would it be?
I've already done it with Punk and with AJ, I think, you know.
Okay, any of the, like, WWE cruiserweights? I mean, you mentioned cruiserweight wrestling earlier, you like watching it, but...
I don't watch the WWF stuff. I stopped watching it when I was there. Okay. The show was so bad when I was there that I stopped watching it, and I've seen no reason to start watching it again. The first thing I've watched in the last year and a half, or maybe 2 years at this point, is WrestleMania, which I was actually very disappointed in. But I love the main event, but I was disappointed in everything else.
Okay.
Although I didn't see the first couple matches. I missed the Jericho one, so I don't know if I'd have been disappointed in that. I heard that was quite good.
Yeah, it was okay. But
right then.
You work, you've worked with people with many different styles. I mean, you worked Goldberg on a Nitro in April 98. It's one of my favourite matches of yours.
Thank you.
All you did was basically selling the match, but you got over so well. You put over Goldberg. You made sure that he was ready for Hogan, basically. But just bits about that match where you tried to run through the crowd and things like that. You know, but he had a totally different style to you. He was a big guy. You know, how do you go... What are your mindsets going into a match with a person that's a totally different style?
It doesn't matter. I like different styles. I mean,
yeah.
That's like, okay, the big knock on Flair, and I think it's deserved in many ways, is that Flair has the same match with everybody. That knock is deserved. However, when you've been doing it 30 years and, you know, 45 minutes a night for 30 years, who cares? You know what I mean? Yeah, he's a legend, so it doesn't matter. You know what I mean? He's so beyond reproach. But what I do... And why you never see Raven have the same match is because I have a different match with everybody. If I'm wrestling you, I'm going to wrestle your... And it was a heel. As a babyface, my matches get a little similar because I don't like being a babyface. But as a heel, you're never going to see me have the same match. And part of the reason my matches as a babyface are similar is because I make the same comeback every match, which I think is a good thing in that respect. But as a heel, if I wrestle you, I'm going to wrestle your style. If I wrestle Benoit, I wrestle Benoit style. If I wrestle Eddie Guerrero, I wrestle Eddie style. If I wrestle Jeff Jarrett, I wrestle Jeff Jarrett style. So I change, I have my thing I bring to the table, and I make everything a Raven match. You know, not Raven's rules, but just, you know, I put my stamp. You know, you've been in a Raven match. You'll see my stamp on it. Just like if you see a Kurt Angle match, you know it was a Kurt Angle match. You know, he could wear a mask, but you would know it was Kurt Angle. But my matches never look the same because I'm going to have a different match with you because you have a certain style. And he has a different style, and it's like, you know, like the old timers say, you know, you need to have four good moves. Another thing is now the young guys want to have 30, 40 moves, except they don't perfect any of them. So you have, like, I say perfect four moves. Instead of having 30, you do half-ass, you know what I mean? And if you can perfect four, then perfect the fifth and a sixth and a seventh and an eighth, then that's fine. But perfect them first. But if I have four moves, then you have four. So we're going to have those. My four moves are going to look completely different in context with yours. They're going to look completely context and different with Benoit. You know, and his four moves, because he has four, and that's how it worked. So you never have the same match, you know what I mean? It changes from person to person.
So another thing I want to touch on is psychology. And a lot of people in the business today and a lot of people who watch wrestling don't really understand what psychology is. I know it takes many, many years to be able to, and I'm sure not everyone knows, but could you just explain, you know...
At its very most basic, this is psychology 101. This is what everything stems off of. And this is where you need to spend the first 5 to 8 years doing until you perfect it, and then you can move on and become and throw little quirks and twists in it. The babyface is a better wrestler, or he's got more heart or more intestinal fortitude, and so the babyface out wrestles the heel in the beginning. That's called the shine. Babyface out wrestles the heel. Simple. Finally, the heel gets fed up and he does something. Dastardly, he cheats in some capacity to get the advantage. Once he has the advantage, even though he's not quite as good or, you know, whatever to the babyface, now he can throw in all kinds of big crazy moves because he's already cheated, got the advantage, and once he has the advantage, he can beat up the babyface. But in the beginning, the heel should never out-wrestle the babyface because that defeats the whole purpose. You know, unless the heel's like up here on the card and the babyface is down here. But we're talking, for all intents and purposes, guys, pretty similar in the card. Babyface always out-wrestles the heel. In fact, the other night, I'll give you an example. I was helping a babyface, I won't say who, and a guy that, you know, gets a lot of internet press, great high spots, but just clueless. And I don't, that's why I don't want to say his name, because I like him. I don't want to insult him. But he goes, he wanted me to help him with his match. And I was like, and so he came to me with some stuff. And I was like, bro, I go, that makes no sense. I go, I'll give you an example. The week before, he did a match where he was during a shine, and he had the guy sitting on the ground, and he gave him the big Finley kick in the back. Boom. Then he took a couple steps back. The guy sold it, got up, ran, and drop kicked him. I go, you just made yourself look like an idiot. You just watched him. You kicked him. You had the advantage. You watched him get up, run at you, and drop kick you. How could he possibly, if you're the babyface, how could he do that to you if you're watching him? You know what I mean? That's stupid. It makes you look like an idiot. So then the next week, the week I'm helping him, he tried to do something. He goes, all right. He goes, I want him to get over on me in the beginning a little bit, because the way the story was. I said, all right. He goes, so what I'm going to do is we're going to be face to face, and we're going to kind of banter about the issue we have. And then I'm going to take a swing at him. He ducks it, and he hits me. I go, you're kidding me, right? I go, you're the baby face. If you throw a punch at him and he ducks and then hits you, he just out-wrestled you in the very first spot. He makes you look like an idiot. You're the baby face. You out-wrestle him. If anything, let him like act like, hey, whoa, go to turn away, and then cheap shot you. You know what I mean? But why would you throw a punch first? A, why are you throwing a punch first? B, if you're throwing it, why is he ducking it? And C, why is he connecting with something? You know? So babyface out wrestles the heel. That's that simple. Babyface shines. If you're having a 12-minute match, 10 to 12-minute match, babyface out wrestling for like, let's say an 8 to 10-minute match, babyface out wrestling for like 2 minutes. Then maybe either babyface gets a little too gregarious and misses something, or the heel cheats in some way and gets the advantage and starts pounding the babyface. Beats the babyface up, bam, bam, bam. Now we got heat. Except what these young guys do is they want to go back and forth with everything. So, but before I get to that point, the babyfaces, they want to get a bunch of stuff in. I'm like, if you don't let them beat you up, you have no heat. And if you don't have any heat, then you have the comeback sucks. Because the whole idea is you beat the guy down. You beat him down to the point where the fans go, oh, he can't come back from that. He's that beat up. And then through intestinal fortitude and the cheering of the fans, you make a miraculous comeback. Except that, same babyface. As soon as the heel stopped him, the heel went to shoot him off. He reversed it, gave him a tackle, a drop down, drop kick, boom, fed up, boom. I was like, why are you even, why? He just stopped you. He just got the heat, and you're already running around and bumping him around. It's just back and forth. He doesn't have any heat on you. Let him get some heat on you. Let him beat you down. Stop fighting back every 5 seconds, because all you're doing is killing the heat, which is killing, and even if you are selfish, then you look at it this way, you're killing your own comeback. You know what I mean? So if you don't want to look at it for the good of the match and for the good of your opponent, that you're killing his heat, you're also killing your comeback. Heel gets heat. Boom, 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 beats him down. Finally, the babyface makes a miraculous comeback. Bump, 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 finally fires up. Most babyfaces today don't fire up. The whole idea is to fire up because it's an inter-emotional sport with the fans. And the fans want to feel like they're a part of it. If you just go move, 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 you don't give them a chance to be involved. You know, Billy Kidman makes a lousy comeback. Doesn't fire up, doesn't give the people a chance to come and, you know, get involved. I don't know why. He has cool moves, you know. I always ask him because I make a lousy comeback. Well, how hard is that to fix? And then after the comeback, then you can go into the back and forth stuff. Same baby face, and most of them today, all these young guys, they go back and forth the whole way. So there's never any heat, there's never any comeback. The whole match should be like a pyramid. You know, you build, build, build to that comeback. The whole match, wrestling is geared for the comeback. And so, let's say you're cut on time. I just cut the shine out. The shine's not even important. A lot of times the baby face will go, I don't want to cut my shine out, I got to look good. You're going to look good in the comeback. Lose your ego. The shine's not important. The heat is, because without the heat, there's no comeback. Because if you're never in any jeopardy, then the comeback's not that. It's not really a comeback then. You know what I mean? The whole idea is you come back. You're down and you make a comeback. It's in the words. But yet, you would think it's that simple, and guys don't get it. You know, they want to go back and forth. They want to make 85 hope spots. No, it's called a hope spot because you're so beat up and you show some sign of hope. You know what I mean? It's not a hope spot if you just keep fighting back at every turn, is it?
No.
There's no hope. It's not hope, then it's just, you know, it's just a comeback. Or, I mean, it's just a fight back. So these words are chosen for particular meaning because they make a lot of sense. You know what I mean? But people, today's guys are just so stupid. They just don't think at all. All they want to do is get a bunch of dumb, crazy moves, you know, which only go so far. You know, the same guy I'm talking about always wants to go, okay, I'll start to come back, and then I'll shoot him off, and he'll reverse it, and he'll duck my thing, and then I'll duck his thing, then I'll hit him with something. I go, why is it going back and forth? I go, the comeback, the people have seen you got your ass kicked, handed to you. They want to see you make a comeback. They don't want to see a bunch of flippity-floppity stuff yet. Bump them, bump them, bump them, bump them. Cover them. No, bump them, bump them, bump them. Fire up. Let the people in. Give them something else. Cover them. Now you can go back and forth. Now it means something. What happened is, back when you used to like reverse something, you didn't see it coming because it was built to us, you built to it. Now every other spot is reverse. Oh, I duck that, you duck this, I duck that. It doesn't mean anything anymore. You know what I mean? That's why in my stuff, you're never going to see that except when it's apropos, except when it fits. You know? And that's why my matches get a certain reaction that these guys don't. You know, and they'll come back to the dressing room and say, yeah, we got a pop. Well, yeah, you got a pop, but you could have had a much bigger pop if you'd have done it right. I'm not satisfied until I get the biggest pop I can possibly get out of the crowd. Like, I'll listen to the other matches, you know, even if I don't watch them, I listen. And if I hear the crowd going to a certain decibel level, if I don't achieve that, you know, for most of my match at a sustained thing, I feel like I haven't done my job. I feel like I've let myself down. You know what I mean? Whereas to them, as long as they get a pop, that's all they care about, you know?
So, one final section before we go. Basically, I'm going to give you a couple of names. I just want you to critique what you think is the best bit about them, what you think the worst bit about them is, you know, how they could improve.
Sure.
If you don't mind. Okay, so the first one I'm going to start with, you know, he's a big star, is Chris Jericho in the WWE.
I love Jericho. I think he throws lousy punches, though, and I tell him that all the time. His punches look really gay. And I have nothing against gay people, but he throws a gay punch. I think he's a hell of a talent. I think, honestly, if they gave him the ball, I think he'd run with it. I think the only thing, oh, hang on.
Okay, well, we're talking about critiquing wrestlers.
Back to Jericho. I don't want to, like, I know in a lot of this I sound like I'm tooting my own horn, but I just know from my own life, so I can only speak from that.
That's why we're speaking to you.
So. And so, I mean, it might sound a little egotistical, but I am very proud of what I've done, you know, and I just find it easier to make demonstrations. One thing that I really liked that Jericho did when I thought he turned the corner was, I was still with the company, and I feel really proud about this, because I said to Chris, and I think it was at a time right before he started working with The Rock, I think, which I thought was great stuff. And I don't know why they didn't continue it, or maybe that's why they didn't continue, because it was really good. They were great together. He brought out something in Rock that nobody else did. Like, he really got under The Rock's skin, which one of the problems with The Rock was you never saw anything bother him. So it's, you know, it's hard to get real heat if nothing bothers you. And Jericho would get under his skin, and so The Rock had to, like, lose that glib side, you know what I mean? Even though, like, he's a babyface. If you're always cool, nothing ever, like, that's what I told Chris. I said, you're always cool, nothing ever bothers you. I said, and so emotionally, you're not vulnerable, so we can only connect with you so far because you don't let us in. You know what I mean? It's kind of like if you have a girlfriend and she won't tell you how she really feels, or if you have a boyfriend, he doesn't tell you how he feels, you feel like you're not really in, you know, in close to them. And you have to feel like you're a part of these people's lives, and that's how you draw money. And so I told Chris, I said, honestly, I think you should, you know, let the people in. I think you should show a little vulnerability. You know, whenever somebody insults you, you never get bothered by it. You just zing them right back. I said, you know, I'd cut a promo where you talk about how, like, maybe, you know, in 10th grade, how you didn't make the football team or something, and, you know, how it really bothered you, and this is how, like, the same thing. And he blew me off, you know. I mean, we've always been real close friends, and he blew me off, whatever, you know. And a couple days later, it was Raw, maybe a week later, and he cut this promo where he did just that. And I was like, man, he did it. And I was like, he's never going to give me credit for this. He's going to, you know. And he pulled me aside later. He goes, what'd you think? So, of course, I played like, oh, what do you mean? You know what I mean? You know, we're friends. You got to play that game. I was like, oh, what do you mean? He's like, oh, no, I took your advice. I was like, yeah, actually, I did watch it. I thought it was the best thing he'd ever done at that point, or one of the best things. And I really felt proud about that, you know. And I really thought that changed the thing with him. And I wish they would have let him run. So I thought that was one of the only flaws Jericho had, was that he didn't let you. You know, and if you watch his older stuff, if you watch stuff up till before a couple years ago, you'll notice he never shows any vulnerability. Nothing ever bothered him. And I thought that once he did that, I thought he became really well-rounded. The only thing I might have done different was I thought his choice of outfits as world champion, I thought he should have went with the suit. I thought put him in a suit would have looked just, that would have been cool. You know what I mean? Like, I thought it would have, you know, like he stepped into the high life. You know what I mean? Like, I know he's got that rocker heart, but I just thought, man, I thought, even, I don't know, it's so hard to find an outfit or to make an outfit that stands out. Like, Shawn Michaels, I loved it that he made stuff. He had the girls make him stuff that was so unique, you know what I mean? It's so, you were never gonna see that anywhere else. You couldn't wear it anywhere else. You could only wear it, you know, you couldn't wear it to a bar, you know what I mean? Mm. I like that. I think if I had to say one flaw about Jericho other than I don't like his punches, is that I think the outfit, I think if he could find a way to just, you know, if he, obviously I don't think he wants to go the suit route, but if he could find a way to really come up with something, and it's not easy because if it was easy, everybody would do it, something that really where you're like, wow, I wish I could wear that, you know what I mean? Because I think the stuff he wears looks a little too mall-bought. You know, I think you could probably find most of that stuff in a store, which I don't think sets it apart, you know what I mean? Not at his level, and not as talented as he is. Okay. So, but that being said, I think he's phenomenal. Huge mark for him.
So one more guy I'm going to cover for you. He's probably, in my opinion, one of the guys that has the tools and the charisma and everything to make it into the top company in WWE. It's AJ Styles.
Right.
You know, he's got the good look. He's awesome wrestling ability. What could you critique him for me? Just basically, what's wrong?
Oh, I tell him this too. I mean, I tell him this to his face. I think well, one of it is I like his ring out. I like that jacket with the hood. I think if he could get a higher quality material, you know, which something if he could get a more expensive version of it. And like I told him, I thought he should have like an inside lining too, which makes it look more expensive. I mean, I think it looks good, but I don't think it looks phenomenal. You know what I mean? I think it looks like what's cool about my gimmick is like, you know, my stuff is supposed to look like it does. Like, you know, I'm from the street, you know, which is part of why I wear it. It's who I am anyway. So I'd wear it anyhow, but it also makes it easier to make outfits. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But like those jackets I have, those Adamant looking jackets, those are really hard to get. They look expensive. They are expensive. You know what I mean? I think you got to spend money to make money. And I think AJ needs to keep the same look, but just make it more expensive. You know what I mean? Make it a higher quality fabric, a higher quality material. You know, I also think that I think the Southern accent that he's working on losing is a big thing. Like, it regionalizes him when he, I don't think he sounds as Southern as he used to. You know what I mean? And I think there's a reason why if you watch any movies, any Hollywood movie, nobody has an accent because it regionalizes you. I heard they also in the BBC they kind of take away the British accent and they make people more neutral. Somebody was telling me that when they like BBC
on the news sometimes they make you sound a bit more British, but everything else is much more
neutral.
Yeah,
neutral. Yeah, because you don't want to regionalize it because then the Yankees don't like the Southerners in the States, Southerners don't like Yankees, California people, you know. So you want to be all inclusive, you know what I mean? And a Southern accent really regionalizes you, and I think a lot of people in the North have a perception that all Southerners are stupid. Just like all Southern things, all Yankees are stupid. You know what I mean? And so the Southern accent, he must be stupid. He's Southern. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I'm not saying there's no basis in fact for that. It's just the way they think. Just, you know, regional prejudices. So if you lose the accent, you don't prejudice anyone. But he is working on losing that. I think he's done a really good job. No, I just think more polish. I mean, there's not a lot you know. I pick apart the little things and I tell him, and next week he's fixed them. You know what I mean? Like, he's really just a hell of a talent. Just a really, you know, the promos could be better. They're not bad, but they're not great. You know what I mean? I don't think they're money drawing yet. You know, I think, you know, if you listen to Jim, you know, Jim Mitchell, you pay to see that. That's a money promo. I don't think AJ's is a money promo yet, but it will be. I just think he needs more time and more confidence in himself, and the longer he does it, you know what I mean? Not that he lacks for confidence, but, you know, something that's not his specialty, so I think it's going to take him some time. But, I think the promos probably, and just a higher quality material outfit, you know what I mean? So he looks more, because the more you look like a star, the more people believe you're a star. That's why I never get when these guys come out with no ring jacket, no nothing, just a pair of tights. And I'm like, you don't look like a star. Why would anybody think you're a star if you don't look like a star? You know, because this is a drama. This is entertainment. It's a part of the package. You know, if the Macho Man didn't come out with all those outfits and all that stuff, he wouldn't have looked the Macho Man. You know what I mean? He still would have been the Macho Man, but that would have taken, you know, maybe 10%, maybe 20%. Would have taken, you know, some of the luster off him. You know what I mean? Everything either adds or subtracts luster to your thing. You know what I mean? So the bigger, the more inclusive you can be with everything, the better it is. You know, the more rounded a package.
So my final question to you is basically, you know, someone trying to make it in pro wrestling, what 5 important points would you give to them if someone who wanted to make it big in the world of professional
wrestling? Hit the gym. You gotta look the part. No one's gonna buy you if you have no build, because, you know, you have to look the part. You need to look like you can kick somebody's ass. I mean, part of being a main eventer is they have to believe that not only can you kick their ass, but you will. That you're willing to rip out an eyeball maybe to win. You know what I mean? You have to have that extra level of thing, you know, that extra level of depth of commitment, you know, that they believe that you'll do. And if you don't look the part, they're not going to believe it. Mic skills. You got to have mic skills. You got to look like a superstar. You know, I mean, it's gone. That's part of that's your build. Part of that's tanning. Part of that's the outfit you wear, how you present yourself. You can have the right outfit, the right everything, but if you don't carry yourself like a star, you're not going to be perceived. You know, I always say if you walk through an airport, somebody should go, "Ooh, he's a star. I don't know what he does, but he's a star." You should carry yourself at all times like a star, where people just go, "He's something." You know what I mean? I don't know, if they don't watch wrestling, I don't know what he is, but you know, I always get to see a rock star, or see a wrestler. You know what I mean? You know, Vandenberg. He walks to the airport. You go, "Ooh, I don't know what." You know, Jim Mitchell. You go, "Ooh, I don't know what he is, but that guy." You know what I mean? You need to be that guy. You know, and why would you not want to be? They don't want to cheer for the guy next door. They want to cheer for the guy larger than life. Sandman made a career out of being a drunken guy next door, except a larger than life drunk guy next door. You know what I mean? Even though they identified with him because he's one of them, you know, couch potato, beer drinking, idiot, you know what I mean? Except they know they could never do it because he's got something special about him, you know what I mean? It's like when the Sandman doesn't dye his hair, and when he doesn't have it bleached, you know, white, and have it cut right, and, you know, have it, you know, the whole thing, the whole, like, whenever he doesn't have the hair bleached, he doesn't look like the Sandman. It doesn't look right. You know what I mean? And then he bleaches like he's the Sandman again. But when he, you know, it's little things like that are really big in the long run.
Well, that's it.
And in fact, let me just say this. Along with that, when he first came into TNA, he came in the first time I got him in. I was like, "Man, you got to go bleach your hair. Go bleach your hair." And when he came back, Jeff goes, "Yeah, now you look right." He goes, "For some reason," he goes, you didn't look like the Sandman." He goes, "I couldn't put my finger on it." Jeff Jarrett said this. Because I couldn't put my finger on it, but for some reason, you didn't look like the Sandman, and now that you've bleached your hair, now you look like the Sandman. Little things add up.
Little things. Okay, well, thank you for your time, Raven. It's been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you. I've been Andrew Maddock, and this has been a special shoot interview brought to you in conjunction with the FWA.
And the BBC.
And the BBC. And shootingstarvideo.co.uk.
And the BBC.
Thank you very much.